Those states were considered hotspots. But if the disease gets into the game farms like the ones in Wyoming, prevalence rates skyrocket to 90 or even 100%, said Mark Zabel, associate director of the Prion Research Center at Colorado State University. Prions are especially deadly. Unlike bacteria and viruses, prions can persist in soil for 10 years or more and endure on vegetation. Even if a herd dies out or is culled, new animals moving in can become infected. The origin of the disease is unknown. Andrew P. Dobson, a professor of ecology and epidemiology at Princeton University, who has studied predator cleansing, believes the illness is largely the result of ecosystems with too few predators and scavengers. He speculates that the disease may have come from deer living in proximity to sheep in Colorado or Wyoming, where it was first identified. Sheep have carried scrapie, effectively mad cow disease for sheep, for centuries. Dr. Dobson has theorized that after a contaminated animal died, it may have lain on the ground for a while, and in the absence of predators and scavengers, which would usually clean up carcasses, elk and deer must have calcium, he said, and they may have eaten the bones of a contaminated animal and spread the disease. The absence of wolves throughout much of the West may also have allowed the disease to take off. Taking the sick and weak removes chronic wasting disease from the population, because any animal showing any signs of it will get killed and eaten by the wolves, Dr. Dobson said. The rest of the carcass gets cleaned up by the coyotes, the bald eagles, ravens, and bears. Without predators and scavengers on the landscape, animal components last much longer, and that can definitely have an impact on the spread of the disease, according to Ellen Brandel. Restoring the population of predators in national parks and wildlands would go a long way towards healthier ecosystems with less disease, according to Dr. Dobson. Ken McDonald, chief of the Wildlife Division of Montana's Fish, Wildlife and Parks, expressed doubts that wolves would prevent chronic wasting disease. Wolves help remove sick animals, but animals don't get visibly ill for about 2 years, he said. So they are carriers and spreaders, but don't get the classic symptoms. Mr. McDonald said that maintaining a large enough wolf population outside of Yellowstone National Park to control chronic wasting disease would require so many wolves that it would be socially unacceptable, especially to ranchers and hunters. The state's approach to controlling the disease, he said, is to increase the number of deer that can be killed in places where the disease is growing. Ellen Brandel, however, said that wolves may detect the disease long before it becomes apparent to people, through smell or a slight change in the movement of prey, which could be beneficial.
Economic divide.
As technology advances and the world can now be accessed via a handheld smartphone, the way in which we earn, spend, and send money is changing. Not only through the introduction of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, but now it seems through digital national currencies something that could change the way we bank forever. China, it seems, is leading the way when it comes to the introduction of a digital national currency, and it's something that, unlike the likes of Bitcoin, will remain under the control of the China Central Bank, allowing users of the currency to shop anywhere, anytime, simply by presenting a smartphone.
China is about to launch one of the most revolutionary financial projects in the world. It's turning its physical coins and banknotes digital. Unlike most other cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, which work outside the control of a central authority, the digital yuan will be the world's first that is state-owned, issued by the central bank. You can use digital yuan anywhere, since it works exactly like cash, except it's on your phone.
One of the main advantages of the currency is it does not require the phone having a signal. Hence, it can be used anywhere. Furthermore, with every transaction being under the watch of the central bank, fraudulent activities and money laundering may become a thing of the past, hence making for a secure currency.
Government can check every single transfer that happens through the platform. They can eliminate counterfeiting, they can eliminate money laundering, and they have a much more clear understanding of who is spending what.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Omid Roshandel, standing in for Kaveh Tahbai. On this week's episode, we will be covering the introduction of digital currencies and ascertaining whether such forms of transactions may one day upset the current status quo of globally dominant currencies such as the dollar. Well, the introduction of the digital yuan is still very much in its early stages. However, the concept has been tested in China, with the city of Shenzhen seeing some 50,000 volunteers issued with red envelopes containing a total of 10 million yuan shared between them to spend in over 3,000 participating stores. So how could a cashless society benefit China? As things stand in 2019, China saw around $49.27 trillion worth of non-cash transactions, an increase of over 25% year-on-year with 2018, hence suggesting that as technology progresses, so then does the ability to perform such payments and forms of banking. The birth of the concept of a digital currency has brought with it a race, in which 17 global governments are now considering the introduction of digital currency. Yet as things stand, China is clearly leading the way.
When the likes of Bitcoin hit the market, nobody really took the notion of a digital currency as a serious prospect of becoming a means of payment, let alone something that would spread across the globe. Move forward to today, and the likes of Bitcoin and others are now soaring in value, with Bitcoin at one point reaching just shy of $20,000, having paved the way for others to start taking the concept of a digital form of payment very seriously. But what if that concept, including the notion of creating a digital currency, not a privately owned blockchain payment like Bitcoin, but an actual state-sponsored, central bank-owned form of digital currency, became a reality? Well, in step China with the digital yuan. The idea has become a reality, with the city of Shenzhen already testing the concept, with participants in the city receiving trial packs of the currency that have been available to spend across over 3,000 outlets across the city. And so far, the trial seems to have been a success. The technology behind the currency will also allow the most remote communities, as well as the poorest communities, to have access to the money, as the payment system does not even require an internet connection. And with smartphones falling in price, even the most hard up can probably afford to use the system. So why then is China pursuing a digital currency? And what benefits could it bring the poorer percentage deciles of the country and beyond?
Yeah. There are several reasons why China is pursuing a digital currency. So, for example, I've got six. I'll go through them. So, first is to track illicit flow of funds. So, corruption or illegal activities such as weapon purchase for terrorism purposes, money laundering, drugs, and prostitution in the dark web can be monitored. Secondly, to experiment monetary policy interventions by targeting those economic classes, regions, or groups who need specific help or support. The third is to promote national pride and nationalistic agenda by challenging the US dollar hegemony. Fourth, to compete with cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and the threat from stable coins. Fifth, to promote the financial inclusion agenda with cheap phones and widespread availability of broadband. And sixth, finally, to improve security of using online platform transactions.
So how will the introduction of the digital yuan affect other foreign currencies? There is no doubt that many would argue that the US dollar is the leading global currency in the world. Currently, over 60% of known central bank exchange reserves are in US dollars, which, according to the International Monetary Fund, make the dollar the de facto global currency. So far is the gap between the next leading currency, the euro, which at 20% of global reserves, proves there's still a long way to go before the dollar is replaced. So what makes the use of the digital yuan so appealing, and why then are American bankers nervous that the dollar may be at risk? Aside from the obvious global business transactions being at risk, on a smaller scale is the notion of remittances. Currently, 50 to 60 million Chinese people live outside of China, meaning access to a quick and easy commission-free currency to send home will mean billions of dollars lost. And now on a wider scale, taking the world's largest international payment scheme, SWIFT, currently, less than 2% of the world's transactions are conducted using the yuan, yet around 40% is conducted in dollars. With the possibility that businesses could also save money by paying Chinese suppliers in local currency, once again, the risk to the dollar becomes ever clearer.
The emergence of China as a global economic superpower has sent shivers down the spines of the powers that be in Washington. Not only is this the first time since the end of the Cold War that another nation poses a threat to the US in terms of ousting it as a leading global economy, but there's now also a risk that China may one day see its currency replace the dollar as a de facto global form of payment. It's hence when the Chinese announced the concept of the digital yuan, the United States were not far away in toying with the same idea, namely the introduction of the digital dollar. In fact, seeing calls for the digital dollar rise in January of 2020 in Davos, with a growing number of voices stating that the time is now to consider the notion. With many nations around the world essentially pressed into paying for international goods and transactions with the use of US dollars, could the arrival of a digital currency such as the yuan pave the way for many nations to abandon the dollar, as the use of such technology would not only mean quick, easy, and traceable payments, but would also see the likes of companies and individuals dealing directly with suppliers and family members in China at the click of a button. In terms of remittances, once again, for the 50 million or so Chinese expats living abroad, the notion of being able to send money home without worrying about exchange rates and commission is also a promising aspect of the digital yuan, and could possibly, one day, see the decline of the US dollar around the world in a whole host of formats.
Many people outside of China argue that the birth of new currency may actually threaten the dominance of the US dollar. But actually, for people within China, the reason they launched this digital currency is not to challenge US dollar for the moment. And their purpose is just to ease transactions and their purpose is to reduce transaction costs and help the real economy. So perhaps in the long run, this may help the yuan to gain some status internationally, but this is not the purpose of it.
With China having already put the digital currency to trial in Shenzhen, it will now be a race to the concept, as other nations also consider the idea and play catch-up in the process. But all eyes will be on China and the United States in this clearly important currency race of the future.
I am pleased to say that joining me in the studio today is Yaolan Fu, a professor of technology and international development at the University of Oxford, as well as being a fellow of Green Templeton College. She was appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations to the 10-member high-level advisory group of the UN Technology Facilitation Mechanism and to the Governing Council of the UN's Technology Bank for Least Developed Countries. Professor Fu, many thanks for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, Professor, I want to ask you about the prospect of the digital yuan. It seems that the whole concept is to make it accessible to all, and does not rely on the need for internet connection. How then will this benefit the majority of its users should it come into full force?
I understand this is a special feature with this digital yuan, that in some circumstances they allow people to make the payment without access to internet. And if this feature can, you know, fully implement it, and this will greatly enhance the accessibility and the usability of this digital yuan, especially for those people living in the remote area without internet. Those people, the poor people, people in the marginalized society who cannot afford to use internet or who do not have access to internet, being able to use the digital yuan for payment and provide great convenience for them in their life and economic activity. So this will make this digital yuan much more inclusive.
All right, how then will the concept of a digital currency impact global payment systems, in particular when it comes to remittances being sent home to China from abroad, hence eliminating the need for currency exchange rates and commissions being paid? Will this impact the US dollar?
I think its impact still depends on the structure and governance of the global payment system, global monetary system, and also the payment system. Because assume someone working abroad in the UK or in Europe have some income which would like to transfer remit back to China. And then that depends on the currency that this person received in the UK. And if this is still the British pounds, and then this depends on the arrangement between the monetary authority of the UK and the Central Bank of China, what kind of exchange rate and conversion system they have. So I think whether this will, you know, fundamentally change the landscape of the global payment system depends on the structure and the governance, the whole global monetary system.
And finally, there is some critique of the digital yuan, with some saying the central bank control over the currency may breach consumer privacy. However, on the plus side, the technology will also mean money laundering and fraud may also be reduced. Is such technology hence a blessing or a curse?
I think this digital yuan is an innovation. It's a two-edged sword. On the positive side, as we have discussed earlier, it creates great convenience in the payment transaction, and also reduce the cost and accelerates the speed of settlement. And in addition to this, as you indicated, it will make the payment system much more transparent, and this will reduce fraud and also money laundering in the existing system that we see. However, it does have some risks, mainly relate to data privacy. However, I think we can address this risk, control this risk, and also address the challenges by introducing proper regulations and the laws to regulate the behavior and protect the privacy of data of the users, of the people. So in the main, I see much more benefits and a brighter future for the digital yuan.
Many thanks to Professor Xiao Lan Fu from the University of Oxford. It's been great hearing your thoughts on this topic.
You're welcome. Thank you. A great pleasure.
Let's now take a look at how digital currencies can have a positive impact on crime, whilst at the same time potentially breaching individual privacy, in this next report.
There's no doubt that the term dirty money exists for a reason. In fact, it's estimated that around 2-5% of the total global GDP is laundered each year, which in figures equates to around $800 billion to $2 trillion around the world, which is huge when one considers just how much that is. The introduction of the digital yuan, however, could spell the beginning of the end for those involved in the underworld money laundering trade, as a digital yuan will allow the Central Bank of China to monitor each and every transaction, meaning that law enforcement, when it comes to money laundering, will be made all the more easier and transparent when it comes to catching the criminals responsible for such acts. However, there is a flip side to the coin when it comes to such transparency, namely, privacy. With each and every payment potentially monitored, should the digital yuan become the main form of payment in the future as cash declines, could people object to their private lives being monitored so closely, or do the benefits of controlling illegal activities by far outweigh the fact that banks can see just what you spend your money on a Saturday night?
The short answer would be no. There will be some groups of individuals who would avoid the use of digital currencies. I can think of at least three groups of people who would avoid using digital currencies. So, for example, those who trade in illegal and unethical activities, they would avoid the use of digital currencies, who would want their activities to be tracked. They will continue to use cryptocurrencies to avoid being tracked and their activities being traced and their identities being revealed. Also, there will be those who do not trust existing financial institutions. So, for example, those from the libertarian persuasion, they will also avoid the use of digital currencies. And finally, the third group are those who wish to avoid paying taxes.
For the vast majority of people, even today, the truth of the matter is that the majority of transactions are being recorded anyway, with the likes of credit cards, debit cards, and online payments, all leaving a trace in our everyday lives. And yet, for the most of us, we don't even blink twice when it comes to this being a problem. It's hence why the eventual introduction of the digital yuan and other similar currencies in the future will only deter those who have something to hide when it comes to their financial activities, meaning that in whole, the supervision of the currency by a central bank in theory should not pose a major problem to the vast majority of its users.
I'm pleased to welcome back into the studio our regular social media commentator, Atefe Palidar. Atefe, many thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So, what do you have for us this week?
Well, digital yuan. That's what you guys were talking about. It was a very popular subject on social media. I picked a couple of tweets. If you go to the first one, China's digital yuan pilot in four of its cities has recorded nearly 300 million in transactions, according to the head of the People's Bank of China.
So my question is, why is China leading the way when it comes to introducing a digital national currency?
Well, China's economy is picking up after all that coronavirus crisis, and they have a lot of plans to expand their economy, and a lot of people are interested in digital transactions and cryptocurrencies, and China is thinking, why not digital yuan? A lot of Chinese are living abroad, and they can use this service, so why not?
What is next?
Digital yuan will combat U.S. dollarization, says former PBOC official governor. China's digital currency approach will favor its domestic retail system and prevent the dollarization of the economy, according to one former senior official, CryptoLand Yuan China.
Atefe, why should people prefer digital yuan over, like, dollar?
Well, I guess China is the second, as we know, second biggest economy across the world, and it's leading the way, and it's looking for ways to combat U.S. economy and the dollar dominance economy that is engulfing the world. So I think they have
plans. I think a dollar is not that well received in Europe as well, right?
Yeah, due to all those trade wars with China and Europe as well, I think all countries are looking for ways to put dollar aside and do their transaction with their currency or a new currency.
So there is some chance.
Yeah, which brings us to our next tweet. While China pushes their digital yuan, European Union is still busy discussing the potential pitfall of a digital euro. Germany is now concerned about what happened in a digital bank run. It doesn't look like we will see a digital euro anytime soon.
So why digital euro has fallen behind in the race?
China is a united country and its economy is progressing, but Europe has a lot of crisis going on with coronavirus, and although it's European Union, it's not actually a union, you know? they're not agreeing in everything in every way. So I don't think they can get united and get agreed on a digital euro anytime soon or ever.
Mm-hmm. Adepa, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
A regular researcher and journalist. Now, in our final report today, we take a look at how the world is slowly but surely turning into a cashless society. So stay right where you are.
The days of going to the bank and collecting a sum of cash to spend for the week are fast becoming a thing of the past. In fact, maybe for some, a nostalgic memory passed down by parents and grandparents from days of old. The truth is, more and more nations are moving away from cash and onto other alternative forms of payments. Just cast your mind back to the last transaction that you made. Was it in cash, or did you pay using a credit or debit card, or maybe you paid online or through a PayPal account? The fact of the matter is, we're all now facing a very real prospect of turning into a cashless society. The introduction of smartphones to the world are a clear example of how this is becoming ever more prevalent, as the technology gives most people around the world an opportunity to purchase pretty much anything from anywhere at the click of a button. With the idea that the digital yuan will not even require an internet connection, the notion of being cashless is further boosted, even in the most remote areas. So the question is simple. With so many of us around the world already pretty much abandoning cash, is the world ready to totally move to other forms of payment, leaving the coins and paper monies of the world something to adorn the viewing boxes of museums in the future?
I think this is the trend. This is the trend, and this is where the society will go. But to how long, it's a question. So some societies, they are ready, but some societies, they are not. For example, in the West, we have credit card widespread so that we do not have this immediate urgency. But for many countries, like the developing ones, China and some part of Africa, they do not have this well-run bank system. So they need to have the digital currency to help them to do everyday transactions at a low cost.
Much like emails replace the fax, mobile phones replace phone boxes, and vehicles replace horses, it seems that the future of cash is also doomed, as technology provides us with a way and a means to perform one of history's oldest human acts, namely, the transaction between two parties in exchange for a financial reward.
The saying goes that nothing remains constant except change itself, and this is no different when it comes to technology. It is, in fact, technology that has now allowed us to shop online, pay bills via a smartphone app, book vacations, send money home, and participate in a whole host of different financial transactions. It is hence why the introduction of a digital currency makes sense. After all, technological progression has essentially forced us into embracing such change. However, as we have seen, there are some issues that need to be addressed, such as the respect for individual privacy, the global currency war that could emerge as nations rush to take the lead, and of course, the very real notion that a cashless society could spell the end of the dollar as the dominant global currency. The reality is only time will tell how this pans out. That's about all the time we have for this week's show. On behalf of myself, Omid Roshandel, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe, and we'll see you again next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump continued to rage against the dying light of his U.S. presidency on Saturday, 14th of November, falsely claiming to be the victim of mass voter fraud and praising right-wingers and conspiracy theorists who gathered in Washington to echo his fabrication. Trump emerged from the White House to applause, cheers, waving, and whistles from hundreds of supporters lining both sides of the street, They punched the air, took pictures with mobile phones, and held signs that included "Best President Ever" and "Stop the Steal." The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Oliver Millman, David Smith, and Samira Sadek. The piece is titled "Arrests in Washington as Trump Supporters Assemble Rejecting Biden Victory." Stay with us for more of Oliver Millman, David Smith, and Samira Sadek's article. Donald Trump continued to rage against the dying light of his U.S. presidency on Saturday, 14th of November, falsely claiming to be the victim of mass voter fraud and praising right-wingers and conspiracy theorists who gathered in Washington to echo his fabrication. Trump emerged from the White House to applause, cheers, waving, and whistles from hundreds of supporters lining both sides of the street. They punched the air, took pictures with mobile phones, and held signs that included "Best President Ever" and "Stop the Steal." The crowd also waved flags including "Trump 2020, Keep America Great," "Trump 2020, No More," "All Aboard the Trump Train," and "Trump 2020, Pro-Life, Pro-God, Pro-Gun." A stand had been set up to sell merchandise as if at a Trump rally. Some ran excitedly after the motorcade. There were chants of "USA, USA, we want Trump, we want Trump, and four more years, four more years." Fringe extremist figures such as InfoWars founder and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, Enrique Tarrio, chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, and Jack Posobiec, who promoted the infamous Pizzagate conspiracy that led to a 2016 shooting at a Washington restaurant, spearheaded rallies that Donald Trump called heartwarming. Hours later, after night fell in the nation's capital, demonstrators favoring Trump clashed in the streets with counter-protesters, with videos posted on social media sites showing fistfights, projectiles, and clubs being used. Police arrested at least 20 people on a variety of charges, including assault and weapons possession. According to officials, one stabbing was reported, two police officers were injured, and several firearms were also recovered by police. President Trump has still not conceded that he lost the 3rd of November election to Joe Biden. Despite a protracted count showing the Democrat has comfortably secured the Electoral College votes needed for victory, seizing formerly safe Republican states in Arizona and possibly Georgia, where a hand recount is underway. Across the United States, Joe Biden has more than 5 million more votes than Donald Trump. The president has refused to cooperate with a transition of power to Biden, who will enter the White House on 20th of January, or even provide his successor with national security briefings. Donald Trump continued on Saturday to claim without evidence that the election was rigged and that he's the rightful winner. On Friday, 13th of November, federal and state officials said the election was the most secure in American history. With no evidence, votes were compromised or altered. Plenty of Trump supporters accept the president's assertions, however, with thousands rallying in Washington in demonstrations organized under titles including "Million MAGA March" and "Stop the Steal." One attendee of the peaceful daytime rally, Mike Sembert from Fort Myers in Florida, told The Guardian he had come because We need our president back, and we need 4 more years. Mike Sembert said the election was fraudulent and votes were cast by illegals and dead people. Anti-Trump protesters have also continued to congregate in Washington since street celebrations erupted when Joe Biden's win was confirmed a week ago. Signs, some reading loser and failure, have been plastered on a non-scalable fence erected around the entire White House perimeter. There has been an outrageous and illegitimate attempt to overturn the election, which must be stopped in its tracks by people in the streets, making clear that the election is over, said Sunsara Taylor, a counter-protester. Joe Biden won and Donald Trump lost. The courts, as well as the major news organizations that typically project election winners, appear in no mood to indulge Trump. The president's campaign has suffered a slew of legal losses in Michigan, Arizona, and Pennsylvania after arguing that ballots were illegally counted. The Trump campaign keeps hoping it will find a judge that treats lawsuits like tweets. Justin Levitt, a Loyola Law School professor and elections law expert, told CNN. Justin Levitt added, "Repeatedly, every person with a robe they've encountered has said, 'I'm sorry, we do law here.'" The bulk of senior Republicans have either sided with Donald Trump or refused to condemn his refusal to acknowledge his loss, a stance that will lead America down a dangerous path, former President Barack Obama has warned. There are some notable Republican exceptions. George W. Bush, another former president, has congratulated Joe Biden on his win. The tumultuous transition comes as the U.S. is ravaged by a surge in coronavirus cases. On Friday, 13th of November, a new daily record of 184,514 infections was recorded by Johns Hopkins University, with Americans now dying at a rate of around 1,000 a day. Nearly 250,000 people in the U.S. have died due to the coronavirus pandemic, by far the worst death toll in the world. Joe Biden has urged people to take basic precautions such as wearing face masks, whilst attacking the woefully lacking Trump administration response to the crisis. "I will not be president until next year," the president-elect said. "This crisis does not respect dates on the calendar. It is accelerating right now. Urgent action is needed today, now, by the current administration, starting with an acknowledgement of how serious the current situation is." At the march, counter-protesters in Washington said supporters of the president attacked them. Sunsara Taylor, a spokeswoman and co-founder of RefuseFascism.org, told The Guardian her group was part of a nationwide protest to stand on the victory of his electoral defeat, to oppose Trump's attempt to overturn this election. Around 11:15 a.m. local time, Sunsara Taylor said, about 15 to 20 activists convened at the west end of Freedom Plaza, just near the White House, and started setting up signs. "Because there were a lot of Trump supporters around, it was elbow-to-elbow crowded," she said, "so the activists decided to move into the street. His mob of supporters descended on us as soon as we set off," Taylor said. "They assaulted some of us. They grabbed, they shoved. Every single person had hands put on them by multiple MAGA meatheads, but we held it together. We marched together. No one was seriously injured in the incident." Taylor's group then regathered, she said, in Black Lives Matter Plaza, the stretch of 16th Street Northwest near the White House, which was renamed this summer. After dark, there were multiple confrontations as small groups of Trump supporters attempted to enter the area around the Black Lives Matter Plaza. In a pattern that kept repeating itself, Trump supporters who approached the area were harassed, doused with water and saw their MAGA hats and pro-Trump flags snatched and burned amid cheers. As night fell, multiple police lines kept the two sides apart.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Abiy, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Oromo, not Amhara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause a conflict to spill over into neighbouring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. December 31st is looming, but the remaining differences are apparently still very significant. The two sides are trying to hammer out an agreement on their future ties that will include a crucial trade deal, security cooperation, and rules in areas like fishing access. The talks are tough, with each side pushing to get the other to make more concessions. Battered by the devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Britain urgently need a trade agreement that would minimize disruption in January when the country officially exits the European trading system. But top EU officials are taking a tough line on Britain and are unwilling to budge. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is widely seen as the final deadline for a draft deal. The situation has piled pressure on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was a key architect of Brexit. He seems to be scrambling to make trade deals with other nations like the United States to make the UK less dependent on a deal with the European bloc. He has used the possibility of clinching trade deals with other countries as a bargaining chip in talks with Brussels. Johnson wants to get the EU to believe that Britain can easily survive even if it leaves the bloc's trading system without a deal. He has long been pinning his hopes on a fast-track free trade deal with America. Boris Johnson was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden soon after media projections showed that he won the presidential race. Critics in Britain and the U.S. have dismissed this as insincere, as members of Johnson's cabinet and Tory lawmakers had openly supported the re-election of the incumbent president. Things will probably be a lot different if Biden takes office in January. Unlike Trump, Biden has made it clear that the withdrawal agreement, which set the stage for Britain's formal departure from the European Union, must be respected. This means Biden doesn't like a no-deal Brexit at all. Meanwhile, Biden speaks very proudly of his Irish roots. He has made it clear that the 1998 U.S. broker Good Friday peace deal for Northern Ireland must never be violated. That, some believe, is a warning against a bill pushed by Johnson that would violate parts of the EU divorce agreement governing the border with Ireland. Biden's stance may weaken Johnson's position in talks with Brussels.
And we've got a much closer relationship between the Democratic Party and Brussels. So this is going to be bad for Britain, no doubt about it, when it comes into next year. But don't forget, this deal has got to be signed by the end of 2020. And so Trump is still going to be president at that point. When the negotiations are going down the line, that's one of the reasons why I think the European Union will be doing everything it can to make sure there is no deal at the end of the year.
Top EU negotiators know all too well that a balance is changing. The British Premier now has to perform a delicate balancing act. He has to come up with a way to pressure Brussels that does not antagonize Biden. Johnson faces a mammoth task. Is he up to the job? The British Premier faces a race against time, as any agreement has to be ratified by the European and British parliaments before the looming deadline.
The beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination? With this in mind.
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low-paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on, and so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, Mayor of London, several government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada.
We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that involved the truth-telling of the residential school system several years ago, and it came out with over 200 recommendations for Canada as a whole to take action to reconcile and to remedy a lot of these issues that are contributing to these violations. And it's very, very slow going.
Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report.
Canada has failed to remedy its treatment against indigenous peoples in this country for hundreds of years. It's the ongoing assault against our people in this country. It's the legacy of colonialism and Indian Act policies that are oppressive against our people, the remnants of the residential school legacy that left our people very broken.
Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide.
So in regards to the water crisis that we have, at any time in Canada, there's approximately 100 First Nations across the country that have lack of access to clean drinking water. It's so bad that just a few weeks ago, an entire First Nation community in Northern Ontario was evacuated.
The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019. The Canadian government has also been criticised for interfering in the affairs of other countries. Canada has consistently meddled in the affairs of Venezuela. It has imposed several rounds of sanctions and temporarily suspended its diplomatic operations in Caracas. In June, Canada announced sanctions against Nicaragua for its alleged human rights violations. This interventionist policy has been in line with Washington's policy against leftist governments in Latin America. The Canadian government is also under pressure to end its $15 billion arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada has yet to suspend existing arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, despite policy guidelines urging close control over exports of military equipment to countries with a record of human rights violations.
And Canada should not just say, well, I'm sorry, there's commercial considerations and there's the fight against terrorism by Saudi Arabia. What has happened in Yemen is terrible in terms of human rights. And the fact that Canada would pay a penalty is not relevant when it comes to human rights. And you know, Canada is one of the only countries now, apart from the United States, that hasn't done anything. Germany has suspended.
Canada is yet to release the findings of its 2018 review of military export permits to the kingdom. Canada is also under fire to hold Myanmar accountable for the genocide of Rohingya Muslims.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.